Hey, this is Sean Ramos-Firm. I'm the host of Vox's Daily News podcast, Today Explained. You know, since like late September, we have done probably close to a dozen shows on this impeachment inquiry, from the sort of early rumors of a whistleblower complaint to Nancy Pelosi launching the formal impeachment inquiry to the whistleblower complaint coming out and the so-called transcript coming out to the Republican counter-narrative to the White House stonewall. We've done it all. But it all felt like it was leading up to this moment of televised impeachment hearings. And the event of that event was the testimony of Gordon Sondland. And we wanted to make sure we made an episode that properly showcased and explained the significance, the historic significance of that testimony. And we did it. And we want you to hear it. It's available in our feeds right now. Today Explained, the episode is titled Impeachment TV. Mr. Sondland Goes to Washington. It's a must listen. I wouldn't say so if it weren't. Go check it out and enjoy it. Thanks.
Hello, and welcome to Amazing Avenue in Conversation. My name is Brian Salvatore. Thank you for joining me today. My guest on the show today is author Matthew Silverman, whose new book, Shea Stadium Remembered, The Mets, The Jets, and Beatlemania, is out right now. So without any further ado, let's get to my chat with Matt. I'm joined this week on the podcast by our friend Matthew Silverman. He is an author. He has a new book coming out that is called, actually, it's already out, called Shea Stadium Remembered. And you may have seen him on MLB.tv with Brian Kenny. He's been on WFAN before talking about the Mets and this book. And we're thrilled to have him on the podcast today. So, Matt, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Brian. How are you?
I am doing just fine. So, you know, Shea Stadium is a very special place to Mets fans of a certain age. It's so weird to me that, like, my kids, for instance, were never at Shea Stadium. They've only been to Citi Field. What was your first experience going to Shea Stadium?
Well, ironically, it was a Yankees game during the time when the Yankees played there in the mid-70s when they were essentially rebuilding Yankee Stadium, and they played there in 1975 and 76. And with the Old Timers Day, my dad took me in 1975. And actually, they announced that Billy Martin was going to be the manager, and Frank Robinson was, you know, the player manager and the first African American manager. And it was an exciting game and all this. And it's, you know, still I counted because I went there. But I really don't count in my first Shea Stadium moment is when we went a few weeks later and we saw the Mets play the Giants in a completely nondescript game that, you know, that is the one that, you know, that I, remember and, you know, never stopped asking my, you know, dad to, if we could go to another Mets game.
Yeah. I want to say my first Mets game was in 1980, it was 86 or 88. I'm 37, so I was either 4 or 6 when I went. But I remember just never having been in a place that felt so huge before. It was just, to my little eyes, just the most gigantic place on earth, full of so many people. It was almost overwhelming. And, you know, Shea Stadium was not the largest of the baseball stadiums when it was in use, but it was certainly this style of ballpark that was built in the 60s, this utilitarian, could be used for football, baseball, concerts, this sort of big concrete footprint of Shea Stadium. Do you have particularly fond memories about watching a ball game there, or was it just sort of, did you love Shea Stadium because you loved the Mets, or did you love Shea Stadium because you loved Shea Stadium?
Well, it's a good question. I think I liked it most for its like sense of place. You know, just that it was some place that I knew. You know, you're like, I used to work in New York, and I'm like, I grew up in the suburbs, so I'm like, I was always like fighting. It's like, is this the street I'm supposed to be on? Is this what I'm doing? but around Shea, I always knew how to get around there, where to, you know, where to park and where to, you know, I felt like an insider, you know. Uh-huh. Going in there, I knew how to sneak down from the mezzanine to the field level seats and all kinds of stuff like that, and really felt like, you know, that was like, you know, my midtown where I just knew everywhere to go, and you know, often went 20 plus times a year. And was lucky enough, you know, after enduring a lot of really bad teams when I was a kid, to have that team in the mid 80s really, you know, made me feel like I hadn't wasted all that time on a stupid team, that it finally, came home to roost, and, you know, those were like my guys.
Yeah. It's amazing to remember back when the ballparks all felt like there were secrets to them. Like, I feel like the modern ballpark today is just, it's laid out so differently. You know, I remember knowing which ushers at Shea Stadium for $5 would bring you down to field level. I remember the one place you used to be able to get a sausage and pepper sandwich in Shea Stadium. You felt like there was a secret club that you were in if you went there enough and you knew all the little idiosyncrasies. And I think that's somewhat been lost. And I'm not saying it's a good thing that it's gone, because I think that in general, you can get excellent experiences at ballparks nowadays with things that I wouldn't have even dreamed about as a kid going to Shea Stadium. But you're right. It sort of felt like your office almost, you know. I love that feeling.
Yeah, and I talked to Howie Rose about it as well. And he, you know, went, you know, he was talking about 10, 15 years earlier, even 20 years from like what I would call my heyday. And he was, you know, he thought of it the same way that he even said, you know, he loves, you know, the Citi Field is great and he goes to the games, always looks forward to going to the games. But, you know, the whole idea of like going there for an experience or for food or whatever is just lost on him. He's like, you know, he had like every penny was like, you know, if he had like an extra nickel, he could would be for like a soda or something like
right.
that. Maybe it cost a little more than that, but I mean, I think he went on there with like $5 and, you know, maybe he had enough for a soda and would bring the sandwiches and all that other stuff. And he's like, I didn't really care what I ate there. I bought enough so I wouldn't be hungry, but he was there to see a ball game. And it's kind of sometimes you wonder about the people around you is like, are they really here to see a ball game? And, you know, it's getting, there were, they did draw, you know, like 100 million people. So there was always people that had never seen a game before or didn't really know what, or were dragged there. Or I've seen, you know, countless people like reading books during a game, waiting for like the fireworks or for something at the end. But, you know, it was, you were there because you wanted to see the Mets or you wanted to see live baseball or you just wanted to be where the people were.
Yeah. Now in your book, you don't just talk about the Mets. You talk about some of the other experiences that happened at Shea Stadium, and for a music aficionado like myself, the Beatles playing at Shea Stadium is, I mean, if people don't know Shea Stadium for the Mets, they know it for the Beatles. And so when you were doing research for your book, what was the bit about the Beatles performance there that stood out the most to you?
Well, you know, it always amazes me how short they played. I mean, they played for like half an hour. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, they had all these songs that were like two, three minutes long, and they just cranked them out one after the other. They realized pretty quickly that they couldn't, especially the first concert. By the time they had the second one, it was a whole different thing. And they were used to not being able to hear, but they couldn't hear a thing. They cranked out the songs. They had like six or seven different groups warm up for them. Ed Sullivan was there, was, you know, a huge deal. And the funny part is that they didn't really have that many, as many concerts there as you would think over the years, but they had like really big ones, and a lot of them were English, and that was what they didn't know anything about baseball. They knew that that's where the Beatles played. And, you know, you had The Who played there, and the Rolling Stones, the Clash is probably the best warm up band they ever had there.
Yeah, definitely.
All kinds of, Bruce Springsteen was there, Eric Clapton, Elton John. You know, that they didn't play there, you know, year after year after year. It was sort of like they all wanted to take a look from what John Lennon called the top of the mountain, which was what he said, was his feeling when they played at Shea Stadium.
Yeah, it's got to be unbelievable to go from playing, you know, little clubs and theaters to playing just this gigantic mass of humanity. Did you ever see a concert at Shea Stadium?
You know, I did. I somehow missed the. I was a big Who fan, but they played on a school night, and I lost that battle. But I did see the Police, which was, you know, a big deal. To be honest, as you know, spent my time sitting there. It was like really hot, drinking warm beer and going, gosh, I wish I was at a Mets game. I wish the Mets could draw as many people. But I did see, I went to see Billy Joel as the last concert there. And it was very special when they had brought out Paul McCartney came there at the end. And actually, Billy Joel let him, you know, play the last song, which I've never seen in any kind of concert before, where they let, you know, someone else do it for something that was his concert. And it was, by some happenstance got the seats that I generally had sat in, like in the 80s.
Oh, really?
You know,
that's pretty fun.
I just saw that there. I already bought tickets to the other concert, and I saw that, and I'm like, I just have to get these. And I, you know, sold the tickets to somebody else, but I was, and then they, it was glad that I had done that, because it was great one last time sitting in the spot that we had seen a lot of the 80s stuff from, because they had a lot of different seats, obviously, that I sat in and over the years, but that was the one that probably sat in the most. And I think saw two of the games for the World Series, not the ones anyone remembers, but the the first two where they sort of made the 86 story into a more memorable one, and they just, you know, kicked the Red Sox butt like everyone had expected initially.
Right.
This episode is sponsored by Stash, a smarter, simpler way to start investing. With Stash, you can begin investing in a wide array of companies and diversified funds for as little as $5. Stash offers unlimited trading with no add-on trading commissions, so you can invest without worrying about getting nickel and dimed. You can choose your own stocks and funds to build a personalized portfolio, or let Stash help build one for you. Stash demystifies investing with personalized financial guidance and education. They can even help you set up a plan for retirement saving. Stash will give you $10 today to get started investing. Just visit www.stash.app with the code SBNation. That's www.stash.app with code SBNation to get your $10 to start investing on Stash. Investment advisory services offered by Stash Investments LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. For disclosures and to learn how to claim your $10 to invest, visit www.stash.app.
Hey, I'm Spencer Hall.
I'm Holly Anderson.
I'm Ryan Nanny.
I'm Jason Kirk, and we're the hosts of the Shutdown Fullcast, your Avengers of College Football podcast. It says here in the script I'm to riff on what that means, and basically what I mean is it's all already spoiled.
Every Tuesday, we talk about everything from cooking disasters to pro wrestling to unfashionable pants we wore in middle school.
We also do talk about college football every now and then, like mascot fights, announcers fleeing the booth early, and unfashionable pants that coaches wear now.
If you want to take college football exactly as seriously as it should be taken, subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app.
No, I was going to ask about the last play at Shea, because my mom is a big Billy Joel fan, and so she and her friends got tickets to the concert, and then they announced the second date, and she was really mad because she said, you know, we paid extra being told this was the last concert at Shea Stadium, and now here we are with another one. And she was doubly mad when McCartney didn't show up to both of them, but just the true last one.
That was poorly done. But I understand the way that they had it, and they're doing it during baseball season, so they really couldn't do it any other day when the Mets were away and still have it like, you know, that same week or what have you. But you know, the people that were at the other show really lucked out, to be honest. And the people who bought the original ones, and I tried to get tickets for the original concert, and it sold out in 10 minutes.
Right. Yeah.
So,
have you ever seen an NFL game at Shea Stadium?
You know, I did. I can't believe I only went to one, because later on I went to tons of Jets games. And I'm not even really a Jets fan, but you know, just ended up someone I knew had we had access to tickets, and the tickets were like $20, so we used to go all the time at the Meadowlands. But I only went to one at Shea, and it was a great game. The Jets beat the Dolphins in 81, and their first time going to the playoffs it's since, you know, Joe Namath in, what was it, the 1969 season. So that was very exciting. They won on I think Jerome Barkham caught a touchdown pass in the last minute of the game.
What was it like watching football in that stadium? Because, you know, I've actually never talked to anyone about this before. I wouldn't imagine it would be all that enjoyable.
It was cold. It was like right around this time of year. Was the days, you know, I would almost say like this, where it was overcast. It was a 4 o'clock start. It was like spitting rain, and we were underneath like the overhang, which were not nearly as bad as seats for football as they were for baseball.
Right.
And you know, it was nice, but you know, it was even cold, probably as cold as I was at most Mets games, you know, that were stretched in October, or you went, you know, to an early season night game. Mm-hmm. You know, but it was exciting. And it was weird seeing, you know, the field sort of set up differently. And it, you know, talk about, you know, it not being fair to the people who had the guy who was kicking into the open end of the stadium in the fourth quarter.
Yeah.
You know, Pat Leahy was lining up the extra point to break the tie. And nobody was just assuming that it was going to be good. And he did not get through.
Yeah. It's amazing when you consider that it was technically built to host multiple sports, but it was so poorly constructed for football. I'm surprised that any team played there for any extended period of time. But that's what happened. It's before every stadium was so boutique and, you know, tailored specifically for its sport there.
And they wouldn't have, you know, in the 60s, or they would not have built a stadium that was just for baseball.
Right.
There were definitely arms that were twisted, and, you know, they desperately wanted a baseball team, and having a football team just seemed like, you know, there was already one there, so let's throw them on there too and make it seem even more egalitarian.
Yeah. So of all the games that you saw at Shea, you know, I know it's easy to talk about playoff games, World Series games, you know, these games that are all, they're iconic to all of us. But is there a favorite moment you have from sort of a more mundane game, a more just normal, everyday Shea Stadium experience?
Well, you know, for regular season, they when Tom Seaver came back, I had skipped school to go to that. And the last game of the 99 season where they clinched, or they didn't clinch anything, but they just won to play in the one game playoff. Those are like two of my favorite regular season games. But, you know, at games where the, you know, there was a 17 inning game I went to, and I like dragged these people there that weren't big fans. And it's the longest game I went to. And mercifully for everyone involved, and that was the year the Mets lost 103 games in 1993. And mercifully, you know, and I wasn't leaving, that the game was like a 1-0 game, and it was over in like, you know, less time than it takes, you know, a World Series game to, you know, to complete. But it was, we were there for a long time, and man, were we thirsty by the time it was over. And just inning after inning after inning, I think Bobby Jones pitched like 10 innings. That was great. And, you know, I would say when Dwight Gooden first started pitching and it started to become happening, and that was when I was going to a lot of games, and you could just watch it building. And he had one, you know, it was a big game, but it was against the Cubs, and it was probably the apex of that 84 team, which is still one of my favorite teams because I didn't, you know, I knew the Mets pretty well even then, and I didn't see it coming at all. And, you know, when I think they had like a 3 or 4 game lead, and he beat the Cubs 2-1, and a foul ball hit me right in the shoulder, and it was hit so hard. I kind of looked because, you know, I was sitting on the seats right above the first row in the mezzanine, and got nailed in the shoulder without just catching it out of the very corner of my eye. And, you know, so I kind of made it, you know, my shoulder was fine, you know, after a few innings, but I was like, you know, that guy really does so hard that I got a real taste of what it actually meant. And glad he didn't hit me with a pitch, because I can only imagine what that would feel like. I'm much closer.
It's incredible that you got hit by a foul ball, because I have been to, I mean, it has to be minimum 100 baseball games at this point in my life, and a foul ball has never come within 15 feet of me. So I don't know how you got so lucky or how I got so unlucky. The only foul ball that ever came anywhere close to me was in Port St. Lucie at a spring training game. David Ortiz hit a batting practice home run off of a security guard, and it dribbled to me. That's the closest I've ever gotten to catching batted ball. So
well, that's a good one. Could have been, you know, David Segui or something.
That's
like
true.
But I did catch one. I think you're talking about, you know, mundane games that really weren't that big of a deal. It was the last game that Willie Randolph managed in New York, the second game of Father's Day doubleheader, and the place totally emptied out, and my family was away, and so I just stayed for the second game. My friend was like all mad that I wasn't driving him home. But I was like, yeah, it's the second game, you know, doubleheader. And David Wright hit a ball that kind of bounced around in an area I was. And I ran over, got it, and grabbed it just before someone's hand, you know, reached up from one of those alleys, you know, where you know, you would walk through. I'm drawing a blank of what it is, you know, where you would walk through, the area you'd walk through. And he was reaching up and I was reaching down, and I grabbed it just before he got it. And I was looking at him because I was standing above him, and he cursed at me. And I was like, and I looked at my, that's when I realized I got that ball. And that was the only one I had from Shea. And when I went to the, I just stuck it in my pocket so no one would ask me to give it to a kid. Like, I've been to like 300 games. No one else is getting this ball. And fortunately no one was there. But I didn't take it out in my pocket until afterwards. And I saw that it had, the Shea Stadium last year emblem on it, and my knees did shake a little bit when I noticed that, and they won, which made it even better.
Yes, and you said it was hit by David Wright.
It was hit by David Wright, and the next day, Willie Randolph got fired.
I mean, but that's 3 for 3. You got the Shea ball. You know, they won the game, and David Wright hit it. That's a pretty lucky break there. You should be proud of that.
Well, I was sitting over there because I was like, you know, if I'm going to be sitting here by myself, I'm going to go in an area that is, you know, zeroed in for foul balls.
Right.
And you know, I'd done that before and, you know, never had anything come close to me. But that day was my lucky day, and that they were playing the Texas Rangers, and people don't apparently stay for second games of doubleheaders anymore.
Well, it's so rare you get a doubleheader anymore, a true doubleheader, a single admission one. It's pretty, you know, it's pretty rare. So
that was another nice thing about Shea Stadium, is that they only had a handful of them in the whole time they were there. You know, those not regular doubleheaders. I actually did a painstaking count of all the doubleheaders that they did play there. And they only had a handful of games of doubleheaders that were, you know, we would call them split doubleheaders. Everything else, even like the last couple of weeks that Shea was around, They almost always had, you know, what you'd call just a doubleheader. And, you know, I never walked in a Banner Day doubleheader, but I went to a few over the years. And in that 84 season, that same series I was mentioning with where Gooden pitched, and there was just an hour. They actually had to stop people from coming because it had been like over an hour of people walking with the things.
Yeah.
With the banners, and the Banner Day, you know, I always thought once they got rid of the doubleheader, that was the only scheduled doubleheader in all of baseball for the last few years they had it. That, you know, once you didn't have a whole house and you didn't show it on Channel 9 it just wasn't the same, you know.
Yeah.
It was nice they brought it back, but it you know, at Citi Field, but you know, kind of went away quietly because it just was not the same.
It's one of those things that I think, given the right circumstances, it could be great again. You can make it special, mm-hmm. but it was just it's a relic of a different time, unfortunately. So
yes, when they had one at Citi Field and they actually had a doubleheader on Banner Day, and they still had Banner Day before the game, I was like, this is just totally lost. this is just slaw. If that's how it ends up happening, this is not going to last. And I think they only had one or two more after that.
Yeah. Well, Matt, I really appreciate you coming on the show and talking about Shea Stadium. I will always carry fond memories of Shea Stadium, as I know a lot of Mets fans do as well. If folks want to read more about you, find out about your book, where would you direct them to do so?
I would say, you know, they can go to their local bookstore, or Barnes and Noble. Also Amazon has plenty of copies there, and it's Shea Stadium Remembered, the Mets, Jets, and Beatlemania.
Do you have a website as well you can direct folks to?
Oh yes, I do. Thank you. I forgot all about it. It's MetsSilverman.com. And I actually, I'm still occasionally putting stuff up about this day at Shea. But I was, hard and heavy into it earlier this year when there were a bunch of things going on, that were coming up on there, and tried to dig up some weird dates from Shea that weren't all just like 86 or 69 and stuff.
Right.
And, you know, it was a great place. The food was bad. If you had a seat in the upper deck, you were not guaranteed a great view. But, you know, when I'm watching a game on TV, I actually have a couple seats from Shea in my basement that, you know, if everything's right, I can kind of just, you know, like when you look at something from the peripheral vision, that you're actually there, you know.
Yeah.
It can kind of recreate it when I'm sitting there late at night, except instead of 20,000 people around me, there's nobody. But you kind of can feel them there. And those seats are much more comfortable when there's not someone in front of you.
Or someone 6 inches next to you, or 3 inches next to you, whatever yeah. it is.
Or you have to turn your turn sideways for the entire game.
Exactly. Once again, thank you, Matt, for stopping by the show. We had a little bit of an audio difficulty. As you might hear, my microphone quality fluctuated quite a bit in the interview, but it turned out great. Matt was a great guest, and his book is really fantastic. Again, it's called Shea Stadium Remembered, The Mets, the Jets, and Beatlemania. Please pick it up on Amazon or your local bookseller or wherever you get your books. You can find more about Matt on his website, which is MetSilverman.com, M-E-T as in the team we all love. And he's also on Twitter at MetSilverman. So check all that out. You can find us at AmazingAvenue.com. You can find Amazing Avenue on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I am personally on Twitter at Brian Needs a Nap. And until next time, let's go Mets.